on the couch on Dubai Today. Get your weekly dose of therapy with Suzanne Radford. Dubai Today, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
A very good morning and welcome to the show. Today I revisit a show on prescription drugs that broadcast first in 2013, and I was proud to be awarded the Sharjah Government Communication Award for Best Talk Show. According to the UK's Telegraph newspaper on Tuesday, stress at work is leading some teachers to become increasingly reliant on caffeine, alcohol and prescription drugs. Talking on Monday's show here about workplace well-being and keeping a mean and lean workforce, popping a pill may not always be the answer to managing stress, anxiety and depression. Access, availability and overdependency is what I discuss with Dr. Raymond Hamden, clinical and forensic psychologist from the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, with special guests.
Your mid-morning music moment on Dubai Today with Suzanne Radford.
I've seen the world, done it all, had my cake now. I am ends brilliant and brilliant now. Hot summer nights, mid-July. Crazy days, city lights, the way you'd play with me like a child. Will you still love me when I'm no longer young and beautiful? Will you still love me when I got nothing but my aching soul? I know you will, I know you will, I know that you will.
Kicking off Dubai Today in style with your mid-morning moment, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Dr. Raymond Hamdan, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, joins me as usual, but we bring you a special show discussing prescription drugs, the side effects and dependency when it comes to taking your meds. Joining us is Dr. Hani Shafi, who is a consultant psychiatrist at Mediclinic and at Emirates Hospital based here in Dubai, Mediclinic at the Dubai Mall. He's also clinical associate professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Western Ontario, Canada. So he's our psychiatrist in the chair with Dr. Raymond to take your questions on medication. Also joining us, familiar voice on Dubai Today, Mr. George Stothard. Now he's the founder of thewritingshop.biz and my co-host on a Monday, but George is also very open about his battle with anxiety and he's here to share his concerns when it comes to medication. Great to see you, Dr. Raymond.
Well, it's great to be here, especially with colleagues.
This is great. It's a bit different for us, isn't it?
Lovely to have the studio to ourselves and talk to the millions of listeners, but now we got these wonderful folks with us today.
And there's a good reason for it, because over the months that Dr. Raymond and I have been doing this show, quite often people will text in and airing their concerns about medication, prescription meds that they are taking. And Dr. Raymond, you always explain your position as a psychologist.
Yeah, psychology and psychiatry actually work towards mental health and the betterment of people's behavior, the way they think and feel. However, we work at it differently. Not differently in competition, but actually differently in complementary, because both are needed. The research has forever shown that when both are working together, patients actually do recover much quicker. Because today, in the field of mental health, we can't separate the mind from the body. The brain is part of the body. And everything that happens in that central nervous system organ will affect the body as the body affects it and the environment. So even as clinical psychologists, we don't have medical training, but we're medically alert. So we will take courses like physiology, anatomy, neurology, psychopharmacology, those kind of courses without doing the medical school training. So we're not physicians and we don't prescribe the medication. Psychiatrists are brilliant at what they do as physicians for the field of mental health. They study medicine and they do the residency in a psychiatric facility, learning to diagnose and also treat with the medication and many other things that Dr. Hani will elaborate on as a psychiatrist. We do complement each other. It's not competition. It is actually complementary. And our practice is primarily psychologists, but we're very happy to have competent people as Dr. Hani, who does consult for our patients when they do need the medications. The difference would be in that the approach of the intake is pretty much the same. So with the first interview, we're probably doing a lot of the same kinds of stuff. We want to look at what is going on with that individual, why they're there, why they came, what was the latest thing that happened to them, whether they're experiencing depression or anxiety or personality disorders, stress, even psychotic situations. They will also come to psychologists for an assessment, not realizing that we're not the ones that will do the treatment. We refer immediately to a psychiatrist. The work that we would do, for instance, as a psychology practice with an educated population now, much more than ever before, 90% of our cases are actually normal people with adjustment issues, whether it's stress, depression, personality situations, marital problems, children with learning disorders, or any kind of an educational problem. And then when we do see people who may be diagnosed as bipolar, schizophrenic, paranoid states, we immediately refer then to a psychiatrist. It's not even something that's a second thought. We immediately, the first thought, we've got to get you over to see a competent psychiatrist to work with you. For instance, when people would see us for depression and anxiety, we go through a pretty much of a strategy different than psychiatry. We don't have people put on medication right away. If not responding to the psychological treatment within 1 or 2 weeks, then we would refer to psychiatry for the medication. Let me tell you what the problem is here. The problem is that there are people who are practicing psychiatry without a license. And this is where we are very, very careful. We will not refer to family physicians or to any physician who is not competent and qualified as a psychiatrist who would like to dabble in psychiatry. And that's very dangerous, we're finding.
Raymond, are you talking about GPs that would also possibly prescribe these kind of drugs?
Unfortunately, there are people that work beyond their own scope of practice. So yes, I am referring to physicians who are not qualified as psychiatrists that try to practice psychiatry or even psychology without the proper training, supervision, and therefore the license to actually do so.
Dr. Hanny, let's bring you in here. Where are we at in today's world? A big question, I know, but one of the reasons for doing this show is more and more we're hearing people coming out and being open about their struggles with mental health, and then as a repercussion of that, getting into the world of medication and getting it right. You know, many people may get some alleviation of symptoms for a while, feel a little bit better after being put onto a certain med, but then down the line maybe aren't feeling so good, but they're kind of left out there. And certainly one of our listeners had emailed and texted the show regarding their anxiety, and this is to do with being perimenopausal. And as she was going through her story and telling her story, we shared some of it yesterday on the show as well, was that, you know, when she went to her GP showing these symptoms and feeling anxious and feeling depressed, her GP just basically wrote a ticket for her and said, go and see two different psychiatrists, and left her to it, and she felt completely left high and dry. So where are we at the moment? What's going on?
First of all, thanks, Susan, for inviting me. I mean, this is a wonderful opportunity, and I thank Raymond for his comments. We do complement each other. In North America, we work as a multidisciplinary team. We don't work individually. So having said that, there is a lot to learn about a psychiatric illness that in the past, it has been ignored completely. Nowadays, the recognition of psychiatric illness as a mental, as a biochemical changes in the brain is coming to the forefront, and people are recognizing that. But until now, if we take 100 individuals referred to their GP, out of the 100, 50 will be recognized. Of the 50, 25 will be referred. Of the 25, 15 will receive treatment. And of the 15, 5 will receive the appropriate treatment. And of the 5, 2 will receive the correct dosage. So we start with 100 and ended by having 2 people receiving the correct medication and the correct duration. Because when we prescribe this medication, it has to be given for a certain period of time. Looking at your listener who's talking about perimenopausal symptoms, it's not uncommon to have all these symptoms that does not necessarily require psychotropic medication, require some supportive medication. There are some actually naturopathic medication in the form of hormonal-like therapy, when in fact it is not hormone, that can help patients like that. And when everything fails and they reach to a menopausal symptoms, little doses of some of the antidepressants are not all of the antidepressants that are not addicting can help. Tiny doses for short periods of time.
Well, I'm just looking at some headlines, news headlines, when it comes to prescription medication. And this is coming out of the United States. Here's one for you. Newly born and withdrawing from painkillers. Pharmacies budgeted and besieged by addicted thieves. A wave of addiction and crime with the medicine cabinet to blame. They're just some of the headlines coming out of the New York Times. That's the United States. So here in the UAE, as we're developing as a country, what are you seeing, the cases, and how regulated are we when it comes to prescribing medication drugs?
Thank God we're more regulated than the United States of America. Actually, the painkillers are becoming a national disaster in the U.S., and people have been prescribing oxycodone and morphine-like drugs that are passing through the milk of the mother to the baby, causing severe withdrawal symptoms in babies that are being affected. Here we have a lot of control. The Minister of Health has imposed a lot of control. Drugs of such kind cannot be prescribed by any physician, and when they do, it has to be a limited number and for a short period of time.
Dr. Raymond Hamdan is here, Dr. Hanny Shafi, and also George Stothard, as we are discussing mental health, but in relation to prescription drugs, concerns about over-prescribing, over-dependency, and side effects. George, let's hear your story. I know it's a long one, so let's get into where you're at the moment in your life with regards dealing with your anxiety and medication.
Yes, yeah, so I've been dealing with it for about 8 or 9 years, and that's a long time to get used to, I guess, living with something like that. So I'm now at a point where I can, through some cognitive behavioral therapy tools, manage on a conscious level some of the symptoms. So if I feel a panic attack or a severe anxiety coming on, I can deal with it without drugs. But I've been prescribed everything over the years. You know, I started out 8 or 9 years ago with seeing a shrink, if you like, talking therapy, which was useful, but there was always, and in fact always has been, a very strong underlying generalized anxiety all the time. It's not specific to one particular situation, although some situations it's worse. So I was originally prescribed an SSRI.
What's an SSRI?
Well, an SSRI is one of the earlier medications that were developed in the mid-80s to treat depression with less side effects than the previous ones. But as we all discover, all medications have side effects, and they will continue to have side effects until such a time when they develop what we call genetically engineered drugs that would suit each individual's own gene, because we're all completely different from one another.
So you're prescribed that. Did they work for you?
I thought they were, but then this is what I find fascinating is the whole placebo effect, and I know there's a whole controversy about that. I thought they were, but then really they weren't, and so I tapered off them.
And how do you know that? You thought they were, but really they weren't.
I think I wanted them to work so strongly, and because I guess I had such faith in them as the sort of magic bullet. So I just, I don't know, I felt they were working, but then over time, the anxiety started to come back, and I just felt actually they weren't really doing much. So I came off them completely for about 18 months and then moved to Dubai and went on another SSRI. And then that wasn't doing very much. And then I went on to an SNRI.
Yeah, let me address all these issues. I think you bring a very legitimate thing here, which is that the medication would wear off after a while. We're discovering as physicians now there's something called the poop-out effect, that the medication that was working in the first few months would lose its effectiveness after a year and a half. And if that's the case, I switch to another medication, either from the same family, like another SSRI or an SNRI. And by the way, SNRIs are very good drugs. However, the science keep developing better medications. So what you use as an SNRI, I believe it was called Effexor. This is a drug that interact with a lot of drugs. Since then, the Effexor, they took the metabolite of the Effexor and made another drug called Prestique, which is much more powerful and less of side effects. However, having said that, all of the SSRIs and the SNRIs will have some minor side effects, such as decreased libido, dry mouth. People may feel a little bit fatigued during the morning time, and so on and so forth. And most importantly, if we're prescribing these drugs to the elderly population, they take a lot of drugs and it interacts with drugs causing serious side effects.
Well, what I was going to add into that is that we're looking at different ways of handling situations. It even concerns me that you mentioned talk therapy. You know, this is the year 2013. Talk therapy went out right after World War II. You know, the fact is, psychologists today who keep up with the research, as psychiatrists who keep up with the research and were required to even get relicensed, don't even do that kind of stuff. We're very practical. Both of us working together give you a very, very practical approach. To go for 9 months into psychotherapy and hasn't been any improvement doesn't mean that you were doing anything. And excuse me for being so blunt. And the fact is, there are ways to deal with this much differently. Let me tell you what we're going to do. When we have a patient walk in and say, we have anxiety symptoms, I'm not going to just take their word for it, because I don't know why they use the word anxiety or panic. It becomes something you see in the movies. I'm going to make a real diagnostic intervention that could take up to 3 hours to do. Also, I'm going to use some instrumentation to make sure we have some standardized backup for that person's file. I'm going to look at anxiety, and if I find that they did correctly diagnose themselves, then I'm going to first put them on a diet. They're going to get off of caffeine and sugar for 2 weeks. And I'm talking about granulated sugar. They're going to actually lower the carbohydrates in half. They're going to lower red meat. They're going to increase white meat. They're going to increase fruit and vegetable, because that has natural sugar in it. They can have honey, not in big spoonfuls, but a few drops. And water is so important. We have people drinking 7 glasses of water, 2 in the morning when they wake up, 1 before each meal, before bath time, and 1 before bedtime. You'd be surprised how just changing the diet can actually create a better symptom reduction in about 70% of the patient, just on the diet alone.
And though they never have to go down that med route.
What you take into your body can really have a difficult effect on you. And that's why psychology today is the study of the way you think, feel, and behave, how your body's working, and how that's affecting you all around. We have exercise routines. We also have sleep patterns that we put people through, whether they're having trouble sleeping or not. Because what the modern medicine is showing today is that 60% of medical problems is related to poor sleep habits. It's creating accidents and things like that. And then we put them through a progressive muscle response that does not take the place of other mediation process, but it helps it happen a lot quicker. When that doesn't work within 2 weeks, then we go to psychiatry and say, here are the symptoms, help us out on this.
George.
Listeners know, Suzanne knows, I am the biggest fan of all of everything you've just said, and my life is clean. I have made massive changes to my life over the last few years in terms of diet, all the things you talk about. So I absolutely agree with you. But I think, frankly, unless you've experienced panic disorder, I don't think you quite understand how hideous and debilitating it is. It's horrible. And you know, I exercise every day. I eat a very clean diet, paleo diet. And I'm sorry, but
it still comes to you. Well, and that's for you, talking about you. And that's such a big area because it's so personal and it's so individual. It's so down to the individual's experience. But what's happening, it seems to me, and I'm very much neutral on this, I'm just hearing everybody's stories. I'm reading what's being sent to me. I'm getting the SMSs each week with Raymond coming through our show. And you're just going, it feels like there's an awful lot of people living in isolation, dealing with this, trying to figure it out. It's not clear. And how can we make it clearer for the individual? So we'll do our little bit to try and make things a little bit clearer. Joining us is a consultant psychiatrist at MediClinic at the Dubai Mall and consultant at Emirates Hospital here in Dubai. That is Dr. Hani Shafi. He's also clinical associate professor of department psychiatry at the University of Western Ontario, Canada. And we have Mr. George Stothard with us in the studio, my co-host on a Monday, and also he's the founder of the writingshop.biz and has been very vocal and open about his battles with anxiety and panic disorders. So it's really great to have you here, George. Helping us raise awareness on this very important area. Just coming back, and I'm going to get to the messages, I promise, in just a few moments.
Anxiety and depression are, in the majority of cases, are genetic disorders. Some of them are actually natural. They happen because of life stressors. We call them secondary depression. It's very rarely to have an anxiety by itself without having depression, and vice versa. Depression will come with an anxiety. So if a parent has depression or anxiety, his child has doubled the risk. If two parents have the disease, that quadrupled the risk. And it is an ongoing disease, and it's a recurrent disease. So when people have their first cycle of an anxiety or depression, they treat it for a year, year and a half, and then they downsize the medication and they stop. If it happens again, we treat it for another year, year and a half, or even 2 years, then we stop. When it happens for the third time, these are the guideline criteria and a strong family history. We treat it for life. And people are shy away from the idea of treating things for life. And I'm talking about severe anxiety and severe depression, because the mild and the moderate will be treated psychologically and no need for medication. So if someone has diabetes, his child will have diabetes or hypertension. We should look at the same with respect to an anxiety or depression.
Were you asked about your family history, George?
Not until 3 months ago. So
after 9 years of...
Now, when I first had my first panic attack, didn't know it was a panic attack. I had all sorts of tests done, but then finally realised that's what it was. Spoke to my mum and she said, yeah, I had exactly the same at your age, and it went on for a few years, and now I just know how to cope with it. But she never went down the route of medication or therapy. Maybe in those days it just wasn't what you did. But then I realised a couple of years ago that my auntie has also, in fact, she's been on Lamictal for a long time, for many years.
And what's that?
Lamictal is an anticonvulsant medication that psychiatrists discovered that it works to prevent depression from happening in people with bipolar disorder type 2, which is the milder form of manic depressive illness. And it works, but it's also a drug that people have to be extremely careful about, skin lesions that can happen if someone gives a high dose suddenly. So it has to be titrated very carefully.
Can we check out some of the messages? So
sure.
Let's really address some of the listeners' concerns. One here saying, thanks for an amazing session. I'm currently on Ciprolex, 10 milligrams since early last year, prescribed to me after suffering from panic attacks. Now I'm in my 30s and feel bad about being on medication so early in my life. I'm still having a few light panic attacks once a month, which is fine. What's strange is that I get those when I'm overexcited, like getting a new job or even when I'm too sad, so extremes perhaps of emotion. Even when I'm scared or when I'm alone in a dark place, then this might come on, this light panic attack. He's saying, do I have to stop now? What's your advice regarding taking this medication?
My advice with respect to medication like Cibralex, which is one of the SSRIs that we're using, is to continue on the medication, but also visit his psychiatrist or her psychiatrist to check whether there's an alternative medication to use, especially if they are still developing the panic attack symptoms. Number two, if people are continue to have panic attack on a single dose, maybe they need higher doses, especially in the Middle East. We have a population, a subpopulation in the Middle East, if you call it, that are what we call ultra-rapid metabolizers. They burn drugs fast, requiring double and quadruple and triple the doses, which is a new test that is only existing at the Mayo Clinic, very costly. But we know by experience that people may require higher doses or switch to another medication. And if that's the first episode, we treat it for a year and a half and we stop. And physicians should follow guideline.
Can I just say also, I wouldn't feel bad about your situation. You know, if you're 30 years old and you break your leg, you get it fixed. If you're 30 years old and you have mental health problems, you have to deal with it. And I don't think there should be any taboo or any fear or shame about having to take these kind of drugs if they're helping you.
Or if you're suffering from any kind of condition, and being able to reach out and talk to somebody and be able to be open like you are, George, with friends and people who you choose to tell, but you feel, you know, you feel comfortable doing that.
It actually helps me, frankly, you know, because there's not worse than suffering alone.
Well, that word alone comes into play again, isolation, feeling alone, and got to allow for platforms, forums for people like the doctors here and for you, George, as well, the sufferers, to enable people to think, I can easily access help if it's needed.
The research has quite been consistent that both psychology and psychiatry go hand in hand, and unfortunately people think they have to go to one and not the other, or sometimes professionals, because of competitiveness, will not refer to the other. And that's very dangerous. Regardless of what your preference is, you have to do what the guidelines say. You have to do what research has indicated to be the best thing for the patient. Not for you, but for the person that is needing your help. Regardless of the medications that you're taking by a competent psychiatrist, the psychological intervention actually helps the recovery process much, much faster. Even when the persons come to us and say, we don't want a medication, we want just the psychological, one of the first things that we tell them, we're happy to do the assessment, but you're going to have to trust that sometimes medication is going to actually be very beneficial to expeditiously get you to the point of recovery along with the psychological. The psychological is not just sitting around having a cup of coffee and talking, especially if you have anxiety, you're not supposed to have coffee anyway. But the fact is, when people come for a therapeutic process, there is guidelines, there is a goal. There are things that need to be done. The research shows that using both the medication and the psychological intervention helps with recovery faster because you cannot separate the brain from the rest of the body. Anything that happens in the central nervous system, which is the brain and the spinal cord, is affected by anything that you think, feel, and behave, as well as what's going on with the organs. So by addressing both, you actually have a much faster recovery. Rather, the depression or anxiety, as we're talking about today, is endogenous, which means it's chemical, or whether it's exogenous because of external events that have brought on that catastrophic sense of death or dying because of a car accident, a near-death experience, a catastrophe that compromised your psychological or physical integrity. So whether it's external or internally based, both actually have to happen. So even if you had a car accident, before you're going to have the anxiety feelings, chemical changes do take place in the body for you to know you're having anxiety. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it works. You don't separate the two anymore. We match them. We balance them.
Message here saying, my daughter's a patient of Dr. Hani, and they're saying medication helps very well. I'm of the opinion that medication is the bridge needed to get to the other side. And at the other side, Dr. Raymond's therapies will be most effective regarding diet and lifestyle, etc., sleep. He also says, I agree with George, panic attacks are sometimes played down by medical staff.
Even though psychology and medicine is a science, there are personalities that go into this. And of course, not everybody is perfect, except for me and my analysts. We were the only perfect ones. I mean, I still have a problem believing that we weren't. But that's my own neuroses, isn't it? And one psychiatrist who brilliantly wrote that psychologists will get tired of practicing psychology when they get over their own neuroses. I'm not tired yet, you know, so I'm still practicing, I guess. But the point is that concerns me is that when we refer to physicians, like, for instance, a woman comes in, is having postnatal depression. Postnatal psychosis is a different story. It's very obvious. But with postnatal depression, you know that there are some gynecologists who do not believe that exists. And they won't address it. Yeah. That's scary. Because it doesn't mean that they're bad physicians. But some people, because of their personality preferences, need to see the exact details and facts. And that's all they go for. So if they don't see it in an x-ray, if they don't see it in a blood test, they refuse to believe it. Where other people tend to be much more abstract in their way of thinking, they can accept the creative, imaginative side of understanding medicine. And as a result, they say, I don't have to see it in the blood test or in the x-ray, and I know that this woman is having postpartum depression, so we have to help her. Same thing in psychiatry.
Raymond, you're absolutely right about postnatal depression, which has been ignored a lot, and people think it's the blues that follows a birth of a baby. Some blues can turn into psychosis and turn into long-term illness.
Yes, and last for 4 or 5 years, too, not just 4 or 5 months.
Exactly.
So message here, I've been on 10 milligrams of Ciprolex for 7 years. I recently had my blood tested, and my serotonin levels were very low, far under the average, although I was still feeling relatively good. My doctor does not believe in antidepressants and told me that Ciprolex will just keep circulating the serotonin in my body but won't boost the levels to normal, and suggested I wean myself off them and take 5-HTP instead. I've done so and I'm now on 300 mg of 5-HTP daily. I feel myself more negative and agitated lately. Was this the right thing to do? I now also have brain shocks as a result of getting off Ciprolex, which happened before when I tried to come off it.
I'm astonished that someone can measure serotonin. They have not discovered that measurements unless the patient dies and they take a brain sample. So nobody can measure serotonin in a live person. So there's a problem here. Electric light shock and withdrawal symptoms, what we call discontinuation syndrome, happen when people stop any antidepressant suddenly. So it has to be done gradually and slowly.
Yeah.
Also, we are discovering that some people on SSRIs now are improving, but not fully. They are left with something we call anhedonia, lack of interest in life, lack of interest in pleasure. And when that happens, a good psychiatrist can really balance, perhaps reduce these doses and add things that will work on the dopamine system. Dopamine is the pleasure drug that we have been created with in our brain. So she needs he needs assessment. He needs to be seen and perhaps switch the medication.
And complementary to that procedure, whenever we are working with a person while you're medicating them, we actually have behavioral strategies for them to do that accentuates what you're doing medically.
Absolutely.
So the medication is going to be changing the brain plasticity, the many different things that are going on in the body, and the behavioral things that we teach psychologically actually complement that and help it happen much faster.
I'm glad you brought the plasticity issue, Raymond, because that's actually has been proven scientifically that the brain, certain areas in the brain, like what we call the hippocampus, shrinks in people who have depression and anxiety. And when they are giving medication, they increase the number of cells and they improve. It doesn't mean that when you stop the medication, it's going to shrink again. If a person have achieved a remission, has been cured, most likely they are going to continue to be normal.
George, you wanted to come in on the effects on the brain when taking certain meds.
Yeah, I'm personally worried about what SSRI is doing. I mean, I've taken them, but when it comes to changing the plasticity of my brain, I immediately start to worry. I'd appreciate the doctor's view on this. I've gone through withdrawal. The worst one was last time off Cymbalta, which was quite bad actually, and I tapered very slowly. I am tapering off Effexor right now, and it's been practically fine. You know, little bit of those brain zaps, but only minor. And my concern is that my brain sort of thinking, oh, thank goodness you've got those poisons out of your brain, we can now start to rebuild the brain naturally.
No, it's not actually the reaction of the brain. The brain is actually telling you you are reducing the serotonin and norepinephrine in your brain, and the brain is very sensitive to sudden reduction of those two chemicals we call amino acids, serotonin and norepinephrine in particular. So it has to be done in conjunction perhaps with adding another medication if the anxiety symptoms still there, if the panic is still there.
The 5-HTP I've also taken whilst tapering off. Is that a good idea? And
5-HTP is a natural substance, and people see also take it in what's called St. John's wort and things like that. They have very little effect. You need to take 10 to 15 tablets to equal one tablet of a Cibralex, which can be more expensive actually.
Can you just explain to me, George? I mean, that the listener there saying brain shocks, and you just said then this. Did you say brain snap?
Zap.
What is that? What is it? What does it feel like? I mean,
it feels like a weird electric shock that sort of it starts in the brain and goes through the body. It's like a judder, actually. I the word judder. It's almost like your central nervous system has a momentary. It lasts a second or two. It's like a judder. It's electric shock's not quite the way it feels, because that's quite different, but it's just a strange, the whole central nervous system just goes and it's horrible.
But what do you feel afterwards when you have that electric shock?
Well, I start panicking and worrying about when it's going to happen again. I mean, okay. Because you're in a situation where you've taken medication to make you feel better, and then you go through this awful withdrawal, which makes you feel, and I know withdrawal from benzodiazepines can be even worse. Worse than the original anxiety, you know, Xanax other benzos. So withdrawal is a big issue.
I'm glad you brought Xanax to the picture here, because it's a very common drug that people are prescribing, and we're starting to, in North America, six states have banned Xanax because it's the most addicting drug, and withdrawal from Xanax is as more severe than withdrawal from SSRI or SNRI, the antidepressant medication. But the electric-like shock that George is describing is something common that we've heard it repeatedly. We don't know why it's happening. It comes from the bottom of the foot to the tip of the head, and it lasts for a few minutes, and it can be extremely annoying to people. So it has to be done gradually.
And scary, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Question here, I'm using Prozac, 20 milligrams once daily. I've been doing this for the past 4 years, as I was diagnosed with OCD causing anxiety and depression. Is it okay to continue like this for the rest of my life? I've tried stopping, but I always slip back.
It's okay to continue Prozac, but Prozac will not be my favorite drug if someone has an anxiety, because it can actually increase an anxiety. Plus, it's one of the drugs that can cause insomnia. If this person who is calling having insomnia, then I would really switch, because it's a very stimulating SSRI. But there's no reason why a person cannot continue. I have a patient that I started on Prozac in 1985, and until now she is sending me a card every year because it saved her life. So if she has no anxiety and they have no sleep problem, go on.
Raymond, when you listen to this, and I know you work closely with psychiatrists, of course, when you realise or seem after assessment with your patients that it would seem that it is necessary to be put onto a medication, to be prescribed a medication, but do you have concerns? Do you think that from your point of view, when you look at, around you at what's going on, that there is too much prescription, over-prescription happening?
We're seeing a lot of poly drug treatment, and this is very unfortunate. We see a lot more of it in the West, and the reason we see a lot more of it in the West is because physicians have become very frightened of malpractice. So rather than doing integrated analysis of all the symptoms, what they start doing is they hear a symptom and they give medication for that symptom. They hear a different system, they give another medication for that symptom. And all of a sudden, those two medications may have contraindications, so they have to give a third medication to prevent the contraindication. Well, with that, they may have to do an augment, and they can go into a situation where a patient might go into 5 or 6 medications, and that's frightening. So sometimes as clinical psychologists, we actually see patients who come in with tardive dyskinesia. They've been over-medicated, and this may require hospitalization for 24 hours, and there's different treatments that qualified people have. And this is what's concerning, and I go back to the fact that there are guidelines. And people who are conscientious, like Hani Shafi, who we love working with, because we know he's conscientious. He also is a man who knows his boundaries, as we do in our practice. We know what we can do and what we can't do. So we complement each other as psychiatrists and as psychologists, because it's so important to realize that medication is important and it does help. But it also can be misused by people who are not qualified. And not qualified means also they're not keeping up the research. So when we see these kind of physical symptoms, even though we're clinical psychologists, we're still educated to know the symptoms that may be the side effects of medications and when to refer and to when to refer immediately and not tell patients, oh, we'll give this a chance and we'll see if it works. We know how to get them over there immediately. Concern is the lack of qualifications of people who are practicing in a field that is not their trained specialty.
As a patient, you need to be really checking out the practitioner's qualifications and experience. You also need to be looking out for those flagposts, those signals, those alarm bells, if you like, if you're being prescribed quite a few different medications. No, Dr. Hanna, you want to come back on that. It's a very important issue to understand what you're taking and to know that the person that's prescribing your medication is completely qualified. Joining us on the telephone, we have a gentleman, Emad.
Suzanne, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm good.
Good. Now, thank you for taking time out to speak with us today. Tell us a little bit about your situation, Emad.
Well, I've been going through, you know, depression and anxiety for the past 15 years, I think. And I remember my cousin actually addressed this problem, and she said, you need to see someone. And I think in denial, you know, growing up, you don't know what's right, what's wrong. And I went and started seeing people, and, you know, obviously I'm suffering from depression, generalized anxiety disorder, panic attacks, anxiety all the time. And I've been taking medication since then, and I've tried different medications. You know, I'm still on medication now, so...
And what are you taking?
I'm on Effexor now. But, you know, I've tried a lot of things. I started with Zoloft a long time ago, and then they moved me to Seroxate, and then I was on Prozac, and then Cymbalta, Cipralex, and now for the past 3 years, I'm on Effexor. And I feel like you reach a point where the meds stop working. I don't know. This is my question here. Does the meds stop working after a while? Because I feel great, like, for a year or a year and a half, then the second year it stops working, and then I feel that I need to move to something else. I mean, of course, meds help, but I do believe that, you know, people have to work on themselves, you know, to learn how to live and deal with depression, but the meds do help, I believe.
Emad, let's bring in Dr. Hanny here regarding the medication, your question there, and also we'll bring in Dr. Raymond when it comes to the lifestyle and how it's affecting you socially and personally.
Yes.
So first on the meds, and do they just wear off after a while?
Emad, thank you for your call. I think you're absolutely right. We are discovering as psychiatrists now that these medications, after a while, a year and a half, wear off. There is what we call the poop-out effect. It loses its potency for some reason or another. It does not affect everyone. Some people have, some people don't. But if it does, what we can do sometimes is increase the dose. And I don't know how much Effexor you're using, because Effexor is one of those strange drugs that you have to use a very high dose before it reaches its effectiveness, minimum 225 to 375 milligram. And when you do that, there is some side effects. And since then, there has been new drugs coming out of the Effexor itself, much more superior, called Prestige, desvenlafaxine, does not interact with other drugs that you're using for your day-to-day routine.
Okay, I'm on 150 milligrams a day. I've started like this 2 years ago, and I'm still on the same dose.
Basically. So you're basically using what we call an SNRI that is working just as an SSRI like the Zoloft, because it does not work on the norepinephrine system in the brain unless it hits the 225 milligram. So my advice is, please check with your psychiatrist if he can increase the dose, and keep an eye on the side effects.
Should he be worried, though? I mean, my hackles go up and think, more, is that always the answer?
But that's the problem. I mean, if you check which medication would suit you, no, it's not more. It depends on you. I don't think it's a word tolerance, but some people develop tolerance to the medication, and we increase the dose. Remember, these medications only came to the market a few years ago, and we're discovering a new medication. There are some new medications that are being developed by Roche Pharmaceutical that are going to come to the market in the next year or two that are much more superior because they are genetically engineered.
That, you see, gives me alarm bells, because as soon as I hear pharmaceutical company, and I'm going to pick up on this in a little while after the conversation conversation with Imad whilst we've got him on the phone. But there's the business side, the money side, and where people are trying drugs and their relationship with pharmaceutical companies and how that can affect decisions when it comes to prescribing. For you, Imad, I mean, how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, I'm 39. I'm turning 39.
Okay, turning 39. You've been struggling with depression for about 20 years.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you're from the Lebanon. You were born and raised here in the UAE. And you mentioned that your sister really helped you initially in getting to see somebody, to seeing an expert. Now, let's bring Raymond in here, because the cultural side of things, the social side for a young man who starts to go through this and to find his way and navigate his way through and being accepted within his community as well.
Yeah, the fact is that cultural issues do come into the situation, and it's not that I can just relate because I'm an American of Lebanese descent, so I know what the two cultures are like. I was a first generation born in the States. And also, Ahmed, I'm your age. I've just been 39 for 24 years now.
All right, cool.
I do it so well, I just decided, why be 40?
What drugs are you on, Doctor?
Well, I stopped that thing. I'm going to stop at 39.
Why not? But the fact is that sometimes people grow up in a culture where they're told, if you see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, ma'aneta majnoon, means you're crazy.
and that's
an unfortunate kind of situation, because like I said, 90% of the people we work with are actually normal people that have various kinds of adjustment problems. Now, what concerns me whenever we have people who come to see us and they say, we've been on medication for 11 years, and they tell me that they're having the same symptoms for which that medication is supposed to be stopping. I'm saying, why have you been on it for 11 years? You should not have even been on it for 11 weeks. So what we do then is we also inform them what is medically correct. They should not stop the medication themselves. They need to go to a qualified physician or the person who prescribed the medication to be able to taper off of that medication. It is so dangerous just to stop. Also, we want to remind people, as one of our listeners has written in, about alcohol. That's a very dangerous combination. And anytime alcohol is mixed, as a matter of fact, when I was studying psychopharmacology, I was told by Dr. Chuck Wallace, who's from University of California, that 1 ounce of alcohol with a medication multiplies the medication dosage by 6. So that was back in 1970-something. They were saying that if you have 100 milligrams of something and you take 1 ounce of alcohol, it's like now you're taking 600 milligrams. Now, I'm not sure if that's the latest research. But
well, come back on that.
But it's very, very serious that people stop that. So your lifestyle doesn't change necessarily when you've been on medication for 15 years. What you got to ask yourself is, why is the medication not helping? So what I do is, when people come to us, and we don't make them come to us, they come to us by choice, is we have the opportunity then to do the psychological interventions. And the psychological interventions are holistic. We're not just looking at sitting around talking about it. We're actually doing something about it. Are you experiencing losses? Have you had anxiety symptoms of near-death situations where there's been some type of integrity problems going on psychologically or physically that's questioned? Also, when do you take the medication? How often do you take it? What changes have been taken? We go in and get a whole history. Then we do the diet, the exercise, the sleep patterns. We even have techniques to lower the anxiety symptoms that complement the medication.
So for you, Imad, how are you feeling when it comes to your connection within your community? Have people been supportive? Have you been able to express and share what you're going through with?
I talk about it all the time, you know, to friends and even family. I mean, if I feel a family member going through some kind of a trauma, or, you know, I know I somehow can detect the symptoms because I want them to talk and speak about it. I'm fine, you know, apart from the fact that I keep moving medications because I feel, you know, when I start feeling that this medication stopped to work, I do something about it. You know, I go to my doctor and I, you know, consult them, and, you know, we go through a lot of research and, you know, we try a different medication and see where it's going to go. And now, for the past 2 years, as I said, it has stopped working for me. So I might be thinking to do more visits now and maybe try another med.
Is it scaring you, Imad? I mean, what do you see in the future?
You know, I've learned. I've learned over the years to deal with it. You know, I've learned how to accept it and make it. It's a part of my life, you know, and I've accepted the fact that, you know, this is going to be a part of my life for the rest of my life. And, you know, as I said, meds help, but, you know, I've worked on myself a lot. But most people don't know that, you know, when I'm with people, you know, nobody knows. I mean, nobody thinks that I'm a person who is actually depressed, because you are a different person. You try to be someone else in front of people. You know, you're funny and you laugh and you throw jokes. But when you're alone, you know, you're a different person. You cry. You know, I cry. I smash things. I'm a completely different person. I get anxiety attacks. I get panic attacks. I try to hide them as much as I can, but when they come out, they come out.
Mm. Do people at work know that you suffer from anxiety?
Well, they probably know today. They're listening to us. So.
And then you feel okay about that? You're all right about that?
I'm all right about it. As I said, I've learned how to make it a part of me. You know, this is me.
I think this is great, Imad, because this is the way things should be. If someone like myself have high blood pressure or other person have diabetes, there is no shame to have an anxiety or depression.
Yeah.
It's a life disease. We live with it. We take medication for it. If it's suitable. If not, then look at an alternative medication.
Yes, exactly.
And one thing, Imad, you're certainly not alone, because lots of people are contacting the show today via text message, via email, sharing their stories. So I thank you very much for sharing yours, because it really helps other people to know that they're not alone.
I thank you all for being a part of this, really. And thank you, Dr. Raymond and Dr. Hani and Suzanne.
Good luck
for having me on the show.
Thanks, Imad.
Thank
all the very best.
Calling.
Take care.
Thanks.
Dr. Hani, you were saying just there that it's kind of a classic case, and it's really good to highlight that for other people to hear it, and to get one, obviously, as I said, to not feel alone, but also to kind of understand what so many people are going through and the kind of medications that they're on as well.
It is actually the classic case in terms of the symptoms and the recurrence of the illness, because this is a recurring illness even after we treat it. Only 10% of people who have severe, moderate to severe depression will outgrow the condition without treatment after the first cycle. But the majority of them, 50% after the first cycle will have depression and anxiety, 75% after the second, 90% will have it after the third. So when we reach a third cycle of depression or anxiety, the rule now is to treat it for life. So this gentleman, I think, have accepted the fact it's no different than having diabetes or having a hypertension, and you accept and you take the medication for life because you know it's going to save your life and save your existence and bring normality, and complement that with the positive thinking that and the cognitive behavior therapy and the different approach that Raymond is talking about.
It's very important to look at the fact that medication is an important part of our lives. However, not everybody has to go on medication.
Absolutely.
And that's something that sensitive psychiatrists are aware of. They realize that even patients go to them expecting medication. We know that some psychiatrists are going to say, but you don't need medication. There are things that you can do that don't require medication. And this is where the complement between psychiatry and psychology comes in. When people have depression, it may be exogenous depression. And when people have anxiety, it could be exogenous depression. Anxiety, it could be caused by an external event, like the loss of a loved one, a divorce, a breakup, deception, betrayal. All these things can bring on depression. That's normal. It's not normal to go pop a pill and expect to be cured. And this is where the two have to work together, because when people
really, really good point, actually.
Start popping pills, they're looking to cure the symptoms, not cure the problem.
So in some cases, it may be absolutely a chemical imbalance and the only route is to take medication. But in other cases, it could be something that you're absolute genuine feelings of depression, emotion, anxiety, even panic, but could be treated cognitively and not necessarily going down the med route. But for some, they think, I need to take a tablet.
A
quick fix. And there are clearly people telling them that's okay to do that. Here's a prescription. Go and take it. That'll sort you out.
It may be a medical condition. A lot of people who have thyroid gland problems or have pituitary
symptoms
gland
anxiety,
problems or people who have an adrenal gland problem, any hormonal imbalance in the body, ladies who have variances, all this, actually anemia, iron deficiency anemia can present with a picture that looks like depression. Vitamin D deficiency anemia can look like that. So people have to be seen by a good qualified medical doctor to rule out the medical conditions before touching any medication.
And we will refer to a physician when we think that's the case. However, in our interviews, if a person said, I had a drowning experience this past summer and I'm having these symptoms, I'm not going to tell them, well, you need to see somebody to give you medication.
Absolutely.
Because that's an obvious exogenous depression. Actually, it's going to be post-traumatic stress
PTSD,
disorder.
Yeah.
They don't even want to take a shower after
Absolutely.
Something like that. They're afraid
Absolutely.
They're going to drown in the shower. So there are times that medication is required. There are times that psychological intervention is required independently. But usually, both working together will expedite the recovery process. And that's one of the things, as clinical psychologists, we recognize. If a person comes and says, we've got anxiety, but we don't know what caused it, I want to ask about the thyroid. I'm going to ask about psychological issues with other family members, parents especially. That's part of the nature of the intake process. So, yes, there are endogenous, exogenous effects. That determines whether we need to rule out immediately or we can try certain psychological techniques to determine whether they respond favorably.
And for the individual who may think, well, actually, I'd rather take a tablet than have to go and sit in a psychologist's chair and go through the emotional process of talking and going deep perhaps into my past or my emotions and bringing all that up. If I can just take a tablet to treat this, then I can just get on with it. And that may be the case, but what we've just highlighted earlier and we needed to come back on is that it's serious business. The medications, the prescription drugs that you're taking could harm you and to detriment to a real negative effect.
I do support actually not using medication for everyone. I mean, I would say 50% of people will not need medication, and we need to evaluate them very carefully, and we need to do jointly. And when you talked about sitting in the chair of a psychologist for a long period of time, people still have the notion of sitting on a couch treated by Freud for 2 years, three times a week. No, it's more effective. The behavioral management technique that the clinical psychology have developed now is very focused, and it's short term, so 8 to 12 sessions may be more than sufficient, and I think Raymond can speak to that.
Yeah,
much
very
better.
Seldom do our patients ever are there more than 12 to 15 sessions, not over 10 years.
Mm. Exactly.
You know, it's
exactly.
Actually 2 or 3 months at the most.
Exactly. So to highlight then, if somebody's thinking, well, it's just easier for me to go and get a prescription and deal with this through meds, and of course, if you're in a situation like George is facing, like many people are facing, where they need to take medication because it's a chemical imbalance and it's something that needs to be mm-hmm. managed, then that's fine. But for those that actually just go, I'm not going to explore the cognitive route.
One of the dangers of psychotropic medication or medication used for depression and anxiety or manic depressive illness, that they interact with few other drugs. And when they do, they increase the blood level of these antidepressant medications, sometimes a medication like Prozac, 800 times. So imagine the toxicity that the person is going to develop in his body combining two medication without the knowledge, or a doctor prescribing a medication without checking what other medication the patient is on. Especially Valium derivatives, I mean, they actually increase the level of the blood level of the antidepressant medication, make them toxic, and people develop side effects on these medications, from agitation to restlessness to symptoms that look like an anxiety when in fact it's a drug-drug interaction. So we have to be careful about
it. And
that.
If you're becoming dependent, so is it the case that somebody could come and see you, Dr. Hani, and you could prescribe something, a medication, and then that person could go to another psychiatrist and they could prescribe a medication. You could actually go around picking different psychiatrists and getting different meds.
Shopping them. Around is a very dangerous precedent, actually, and I've seen it happening. People going to get a Valium derivative from one psychiatrist and an antidepressant from another psychiatrist without telling him. So a prudent psychiatrist should really act as an investigator, ask very carefully and look at the symptoms and look at withdrawal symptoms, because tremors and things like that and sweating and restlessness and lack of sleep are very common signs of withdrawal from Xanax and Lexotonil, which is another actually culprit in the market nowadays.
Paroxetine.
Okay.
Somebody here, a listener, texted in actually a few weeks ago, and we promised we'd address it. We called him yesterday. I know he's listening. He's been taking this for 12 plus years, and he says he can't imagine life without it because the withdrawal symptoms are just terrible. He says, would I be able to lead a normal life without this medication?
Well, most likely, if he has been on this medication for the past 12 years, it's indicated for the rest of his life, or if he has tried and stopped it and then he developed the symptoms again, it means he will need it. As long as he has no side effects on this medication, and the most common side effects on paroxetine is some weight gain. People appetite improve when their mood improves, so they eat more. But some drugs make people eat more than another. Paroxetine, it's a wonderful drug. I'm still prescribing myself, but again, he has to be careful. Loss of libido and some sexual dysfunction can be a problem, but people have to put things into perspective and choose.
But to come off it?
Actually, if he has a chronic recurrent condition, my question to him or her, why should you come off the medication? Mm. You continue. It depends on the age. As we grow older, actually, once we hit our 40s and 50s, people should continue on the medication for the rest of their lives, because the recurrence is going to be much faster. The cycle would be much shorter.
So, gentlemen, let me reintroduce you quickly. If people are not aware who you are, we have Dr. Roman Hamdan here, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. He's talking on the psychological point of view and side when it comes to mental health. And when it comes to prescribing medication, then we have Dr. Hani Shafi, consultant psychiatrist at MediClinic at the Dubai Mall, and also at Emirates Hospital here in Dubai. He's a clinical and associate professor of department psychiatry at the University of Western Ontario, Canada. Also, and Mr. George Stothard, my co-host on a Monday, who has been suffering from anxiety for 9 years and has been taking medication responsibly. He's managed to come off certain meds, gone on to others, and is in the process of coming off medication at the moment too. So let's go to the message that came in earlier regarding a child, and interesting to look at this when it comes to prescription medication. So 15-year-old son, he's been on 10 milligrams of Ciprolex since he was 10 years of age, and the parents asking, should they take him off this now? Dr. Hani.
It really depends on his diagnosis. I don't know what diagnosis was he given. Some children develop severe obsessive compulsive disorder, which is way above and beyond the behavioral management, and especially if it's a genetic, because we know obsessive compulsive disorder genetic. We need an SSRI, because that's a serious serotonin deficiency. Of course, one has to be careful about the dosage given to children. Anything under 12 or 13, we use minimum doses, and we use half the dose of this medication. Some other conditions, people have prescribed medication such as Prozac, like people with hyperactivity who are not responding very well to the traditional stimulant medication. They use small doses. So one has to know what's the diagnosis of the child. Some of these drugs are not FDA approved, by the way. So again, the caller or the person who has sent the note need to check with their psychiatrist whether it's FDA approved, Federal Drug Administration approved in the U.S. or not.
There's many research that's going on, and psychiatry has its very sophisticated form of research. And of course, because it's psychiatry, it's going to focus on the biological, the chemical, and how to medicate. The psychological, however, addresses the same issues, but from a different treatment angle. As a matter of fact, we will not see obsessive-compulsive disorder necessarily as genetic. But we do know that when people learn to behave obsessive-compulsive, there will be a change in the brain. So when you look at the brain, we look at brain plasticity, the research that came out 16 years ago and was published in Psychological Research. So when we look at the brain and a person is behaving OCD, of course, there's going to be that brain image showing that it's OCD. Which came first, the brain structure causing the symptoms, or the person learning to behave obsessive-compulsive, changing the brain through that brain plasticity? Now, when we treat this as psychological, we do have techniques, whether they're children or adults, to actually lessen the symptoms of OCD. If those symptoms do change, does that mean that that symptom change has caused another change in the brain where that place in the brain does not show OCD anymore? Psychiatry is going to look at it from that medical angle. Psychological and approaches will be a little bit different, even though we're wanting to change the behavior.
I'm going to agree with Raymond, because yes, some cases that have OCD works very well with behavior management techniques, but I'm talking about the most severe ones that you need to combine both the behavior management approach and the medication if there has been established family history, and if the behavior management techniques have not really achieved the results. But if you can combine the two, not for every case, it's a mild, moderate, and severe, as I said. So the mild and the moderate, definitely, Doctors, behavioral management will work.
Can I just bring it back to the children just for a minute? Because I want to hear your views. I don't have kids, but I'm assuming at that age, 10 to 16, say, that the brains are still forming, that they're also not equipped with the adult ability to be able to cope with their emotions. So if you start giving children this age drugs that are playing with their brains, is there a risk of serious side effects or an inability for them to cope?
As a matter of fact, the children that take drugs are the least number of patients, because one has to be extremely careful. And I do agree with you about the brain growth in children and the neurological growth of children. But some of the conditions that start early in life, whether it's a severe serious behavior problem from autism or people with Asperger's syndrome that are causing serious problems, or people who are harming themselves, like the autistic children, those with severe hyperactivity that are completely out of control, there are indication for medication that has been approved, researched consistently for the past 25 years and 30 years. But you can also combine the psychological management. So one has to be very careful. I do not prescribe to children haphazardly. One has to do a serious assessment of a child. You're right. A child is different than an adult. Anything that exceeds 12 or 13, we're becoming a puberty age, they have a liver function test that is as equal as an adult, and there is no problem for a teenager actually to take the same dose, although with tremendous care.
The message here from Kath, really sort of echoing what both of you are saying. She says, for someone who's been lucky enough to never require medication for depression, although I have been diagnosed, I was able to treat it with exercise, diet, education and lifestyle changes. I have to say that to hear of young people so dependent on these drugs to get by horrifies me. Surely the aim should be to ultimately to get people off the medication.
I certainly don't want to get into conspiracy theory, and we're not going to, but with the hopes that Dr. Haney will actually come back and join us on the show at some other point, because now we need to get into a really stimulating conversation. That's going to take another show. We've got a new diagnostic manual that's come out. It's the DSM-5.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of criticism about it because it's making diagnosing too easy. Unfortunately, it's not only psychiatrists and clinical psychologists who use this diagnostic manual. It's also people who are not qualified in either field that are using
Correct.
It. And 52% of the people who were actually consulting to put this document together when it was the DSM-4 were on the payroll of drug companies.
I feared you were going to say that.
The DSM-5, 69% of the people who were consulting to put it together were on the payroll of drug companies. Drug companies have enough money, they can come up with any research they want. And what we know about statistics is you have liars, damn liars, and statisticians. So you have to have a qualified ethical professional who knows how to correctly interpret it and make sure it's not going to be at the expense of the patient.
So coming back on that point there, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders that Dr. Raymond was highlighting, and the connection with drug companies, with pharmaceuticals. So Dr. Haney, you wanted to come back on that.
Actually, the drug companies have developed very rigorous policies, especially in North America. I'm not talking about European companies, but the North American companies have now a code of ethics and a conflict of interest policy. Maybe the doctors are sitting on the advisory board, but they cannot promote or advertise about any drug. As a matter of fact, anyone who does that has been terminated from their jobs. There may be some of the unethical ones, but right now, compared to 20 years ago, it's a very, very rigorous criteria. Also, talking about the statistical manual, we are really still sailing in the dark when it comes to the human body. There's something called the Human Genome Program, and when the Human Genome Program is completed, then we will treat people appropriately. We will treat people with what's called a designer medication. It's like designing a program for someone, like Raymond's programs. A designer drug will work for that individual person and will not suit the other person. The dosage will be individualized for every person. So this is the future. I mean, I'm 63. I don't know if I'm going to see it in the future. It's going to take time, but the future is exciting.
Well, I'm 63 and I'm much younger than you.
lots to get through. Let's address some of the messages from our listeners. One here, my brother's suffering from schizophrenia. He's been on medical drugs for the past 15 years. Is this ever curable? Schizophrenia, can it be cured?
No, It's a chronic, recurrent disease. However, a person can be improved to a point of being functional in the society. But for someone to think that they're going to stop the medication, the person is going to take the medication for the rest of his life.
And medication has actually improved quite a bit, because in the United States, when we were working with schizophrenics, we found that every 2 years they would have to go back to be re-medicated or reassessed. Now it's gotten so sophisticated, it's up to about once every 5 years before they go into another episode and have to be reassessed by being hospitalized and detoxed from the medication and re-medicated. So medication for schizophrenia, bipolar, has come very, very sophisticated now and has had a wonderful effect for people's lives. And this is also a point where families need to be involved in this. The patient is not the problem. The family has got to recognize that the family has to intervene, because it is a family problem as well.
As a matter of fact, every psychiatric illness, you need to involve the family, because once you involve them, they become part of the treatment and they accept the nature of the illness of the person.
We're talking there about the business side, if you like, and a very good point has been raised here. This isn't necessarily covered on insurance, on medical insurance. So, you know, paying for consultations, paying for medications, and what about those people who can't afford meds, and also to insurance companies as well? Why is it not being included more in insurance?
Most companies are covering psychological and psychiatric care, but it depends on the policy that you purchase. What you have to be very careful with, though, is there are insurance companies that really just want to take your money and they don't want to pay for anything. There may be a statute of limitations. So in other words, you'll see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and that person will send your insurance forms in for you, or you do it yourselves. They're sent back because they didn't cross the T or dot the I. And by the time that it's all worked out, you've passed the statute of limitations. So you have to be careful whether your company is really wanting to pay or not. The ones who are really sincere about covering for psychological and psychiatric coverage will find that they actually save money. The research shows whenever there is mental health facilitation, even for medical problems, it's behavioral medicine. It's health psychology and psychiatry. Patients get better much, much quicker, and insurance companies actually save a lot of money by incorporating the mental health professionals.
A couple of people have talked about special centers or support groups, that kind of thing. Are we seeing that here in the UAE?
When it comes to support groups, we're really lacking, and I'm glad George is here, and this is an invitation for people to start forming advocacy and support groups similar to the cancer of the breast support groups. There are some addiction support groups like the Alcoholic Anonymous, like the Overeaters Anonymous. All these support groups need to be done. I don't see it for depression or anxiety, and we need to do that, and we need to see that.
I'm very, very happy for anybody listening to get in touch with me directly. It's been on my mind. I am busy in lots of ways, but I'm very keen actually to set up some kind of support group, and I've talked to you about that before, Suzanne. So anybody listening, you can get in touch with me.
Well, give out your email address,
So it's george@therightingshop.biz.
george@therightingshop.biz. And we'll follow up on that as well. I think we can go about helping a little bit, I think, with perhaps, you know, finding a space for people to meet regularly and offer that support. Coming back on the person earlier that was saying about having their serotonin levels measured, and you said, Dr. Hanny, that, you know, that can't be the case. Now, they've come back obviously concerned about that, because they got their sent to a lab in Germany, and it goes on to say, is it true that Ciprolex can't increase serotonin levels and that 5-HTP is a better option?
5-HTP is actually not a better option. Ciprolex will increase the serotonin. And in terms of measuring serotonin, maybe there's a little bit of confusion. In the old days, and even some centers recently, test for cortisol, and it's called cortisol suppression. And by testing for cortisol, they think that they can measure serotonin, but it's a very non-specific method of measuring. There's no accurate measurements of serotonin. Even if they do a spinal cord tap, that serotonin coming in the spinal cord is not the same like the brain serotonin.
Message here: I think alternative or natural medicine and diet changes are more important to aiding any forms of depression. Also, to find the original triggers that cause the symptoms, removing the triggers, some CBT and lots of TLC, and understanding from family and friends really, really helps. They say a lot of depression and panic attacks are created in the mind, so focusing and understanding the importance of controlling our thoughts make a huge difference. What are your thoughts on that, George?
I totally agree. I wrote a note here. There was a time when I didn't have this, and I sort of wonder what happened. And one thing I do think is true is I've always been someone who's sort of been very much isolated. Went to uni, went to London, came here. I've always been a sort of lone wanderer, if you like. And I think that's to my detriment emotionally, and I think that's probably a common thing nowadays with people traveling and working alone. So I think working on myself and learning to seek out love and work on my friendships, that sort of thing really, really helps.
But what they're saying is that you don't need to go down the medication route if you can sort those triggers and those issues out. And so it kind of brings us full circle, yeah, doesn't it, to again, going over it, Dr. Raymond, Dr. Hani, when one really needs to go on medication and when one can seek help and support and overcome these feelings in another way.
There's 7 billion people on this planet, and there's 7 billion different people. We have different metabolism. We have different preferences. Now, some people don't respond very well to herbal treatment. Others do much, much better on the traditional medical treatment. Some people don't want treatment at all that's medical or herbal. They want to go down the psychological route. However, there are certain illnesses that require medication. When I hear of psychiatrists who are using herbal medicine to treat schizophrenia, that scares the hell out of me. That is not legitimate. That is not scientific. And it's very concerning because of the information that we know today concerning psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar, and some of the others like that. It needs to have a medication that is scientifically tested, that's been through the trials, that's FDA approved, any kind of approval that says this is the medication that works. Herbal medicine is still experimental. The concern is that even if it works, a person may even overdose on herbal. How do you counter that? This is also the problem with vitamins. People don't know you can actually overdose on vitamins. What is the counteraction for that?
But they also have their place depending what it is, what your condition is. You know, if you're saying that you don't need to go down a medical route to heal and to recover, you could go down a psychological
route. Exactly, like things like John Wort, which was St. John's Wort. That was actually a beautiful example. Now it's accepted by medicine. And medical people will prescribe it, or they will recommend that you take it. But it has been through the track. It has run the track. But also, there are people that say Ritalin may not be the best drug, but the reason we use it is because it's been around for 60 years, and we know how to use it. That's not a very good excuse to be using a medication that can be very harmful.
Dr.
Yeah.
Hani.
I do agree. In terms of illnesses such as schizophrenia, as a matter of fact, the research coming from Melbourne now is stating that if we start treating a teenager, that we see pre-schizophrenic symptoms early on at age 15, because the illness developed by late teens, we treat it continuously for 5 years, nonstop, we may even avert the whole syndrome from developing in the future. Back to what George was saying, the support system is tremendous. Having a support system, as a matter of fact, a research done in California over 30 years ago showed that a woman who has 3 younger children and have no support system are more depressed and develop depression versus a woman who have one good friend. So having one good friend can actually help prevent your depression and treat your depression.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. This is to be revisited at a later stage, maybe in September when everybody is back. It is an ongoing discussion, the benefits, the disadvantages of medication when it comes to prescribed medication to do with mental health. Dr. Hani, your contact details, how people can get in touch with you.
I'll leave my contact details here.
Okay.
So I'm at the Emirates Hospital 1 day a week. I'm at the Dubai Mall 3 days a week.
At Mediclinic
there. Mediclinic, yes.
Thank you very much. Mr. George, thank you as always. Thank